On the line with us, we have Dr. Charles Rousseau. He is a professor of law in the School of Law at the University of Dayton, Ohio, amongst many other hats he wears. But we like to call him Charlie, the dean of the best cannolis in New York City.
Yeah.
Charlie. Good morning, Todd. Lillen, thanks very much. How are you?
Oh, fantastic, great.
Charlie. Always good to talk to you.
Oh. In line with that, do we say buongiorno?
Yeah.
There you go. There you go, baby. We got to get Charlie down in studio.
Oh, yeah.
Him and Tom Riello, they'd be good friends.
We know other Italians in the state of Alabama, Charlie. Yeah.
Actually, we stopped in Tuscaloosa once on the way to New Orleans.
Well, okay.
Did you go to Dreamland? Uh-huh. Get the best ribs ever?
Uh-huh. Absolutely.
So we're looking at a couple articles here. The SCOTUS decision on the website designer. Yeah. In Colorado.
Three Creative, yes.
Right, yeah. So that kind of laid out, but you kind of pointed out in your article in Catholic World Report the thought process of this dissenting justices and how that kind of could be a bit of a red flag for us. Could you dive into that?
I'm sorry, say that again, please. It just broke up a little bit.
Oh, okay. So in the case, the three justices that dissented from the majority, which said this did not impose upon someone's free speech, but their reasoning didn't really seem that sound.
I think that's kind.
Okay.
One of the things I'd like to say, if you don't mind, is to clear it up. What a lot of people misunderstand is this is not about religious freedom, and it's not about discrimination. Rather, it's a case about free speech that implicates religious freedom. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court's got a history, and that's kind of where the justices went off the rail, of ruling all the way back to the 1940s that you cannot make somebody say something that she or he does not agree with. And expressive speech is a subcategory of speech called pure speech. That is to say, how we dress, what we post about ourselves, leaves a lot to be open to interpretation. When I teach, for example, I always wear a jacket and a tie. I don't know about you guys, but I've got a problem. I've got a magic closet at home. Every suit that I put in there, it shrinks only the pants. I have to wear a sports jacket. But, when I go with the class as a full professor, I think I have an obligation to dress in a certain way, and it says something about the way we're expected to be. Well, by analogy, when I post something on a website that I create, I think a reasonable observer or reader, if you will, would get the point that I agree with it. And so the young woman here said that, look, I'll serve anybody, but I'm just not I'm not willing to make a website that expresses something I don't believe in, because I believe that marriage is a relationship between one man and one woman. And so when Justice Sotomayor went off the deep end, herself a Roman Catholic, as I think we'd say, described it as a sad day for people who are gay, it's really not that. It's upholding this woman's right to free speech and to express ideas that she believes in. The Supreme Court pointed out three cases in which that happened. One going all the way back to World War II, Barnett, a case from West Virginia, where public officials tried to mandate that everybody salute the Pledge of Allegiance, recite the Pledge of Allegiance, and they thought, the Jehovah's Witnesses, that was essentially worshiping the state in lieu of God. The Supreme Court ruled the same way in a case involving the Boy Scouts and involving a case with the St. Patrick's Day parade in Boston, and 4 years ago, I think it was 4 years ago, the court addressed a case from Illinois where a social worker refused to pay union dues because he said, look, my money is going to support things with which I don't agree, and the Supreme Court ruled that compelled speech cannot be required. On top of that, and I don't want to cut you guys off, the Supreme Court always cries about precedent. When the Supreme Court invalidated Roe, they said, oh, my God, it's precedent. You can't overturn precedent. Well, in this case, they ignored pretty strong precedent to the contrary because it reached the result they wanted. So I think at the very least, they're being inconsistent. in more specifically being somewhat partisan, I think it's just plain old disingenuous, and they're trying to get a result they wanted, the status of precedent and the law notwithstanding.
Which in the highest court, though, Charlie, I don't expect this. Like, I've got a friend of mine who's a judge, and I enjoy talking to him. I'm not really a legal guy. I've never been to law school, but it's fun. It's fun for me because for me, it comes down to philosophy. And so I enjoy talking about that stuff. And what he talks about is the cases that he is disliked the most are the ones that he has to rule in favor of, even though he's in disagreement of it, because he's following the law. And exactly. I think that's what the Supreme Court justices should be doing. Right, Charlie?
Exactly. And I mean, as you know, Todd, I'm sure justices tend to be categorized in one of two categories, as activist or originalist. Activists are the ones who accept the more traditional, the way they want to interpret it, as you just described. The originalist or judicial restraint try to interpret it as written. And I just read an article yesterday, as a matter of fact, in a magazine that's verboten to a lot of people on university campuses, National Review, that was tracing the Roberts Court's history. And it has shown more respect for precedent than previous courts. So it's not an activist court, and they are trying to apply the law as it was written. And then, you know, when you get down to it, everybody talks about precedent, but the Supreme Court's the only court not bound to precedent. If precedent really mattered, would the left Plessy v. Ferguson?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
But that being said, in this case, at least on the question of compelled speech, if you will, the precedent was clear. It goes all the way back to World War II that you can't make somebody say something that she or he doesn't want to, and they're trying not to rewrite the law just to reach a result that they thought the court should reach.
Well, they're certainly not going to support Dred Scott. They're not going to hold that as a precedent, are they, Charlie?
Nor should they.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but I think you're exactly right that it's selective interpretation, and you know, a judge from the Seventh Circuit, Posner, years ago, talked about the courts rewriting statutes, creative judicial updating, he called it.
So it feels sometimes these dissents are a bit on the emotional side rather than the side of law and precedent. Does that seem like a precedent for a lot of the dissents that are coming against? Because as you said, this court is upholding a lot of constitutional law in their rulings. But yet you've got these voices that in some of the comments the justices make about why they dissent, they kind of bring a lot of emotion and feeling into them rather than the argument of law.
Exactly. And I teach online mostly, so now I get papers that come in online. I don't get the great hard copy. But when I would great hard copy, teaching in the School of Education where I have a joint appointment, very often students would say, the court felt. And when I get the word felt, I circle it about 20 times, and I write in the margin, the courts do exactly what you just said, Ellen. They're not supposed to feel. They're supposed to reason. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to think. It's not about my emotions. It's as Todd said, it's what does the law say and what does the law mandate?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, Chief Justice Roberts, when he was confirmed some years ago, used a line that I used as the title of an article one time. He said, judges should be rulemakers, not umpires, not rulemakers. Mm-hmm. They call it, to go back to your little lead in about Ohtani and baseball, is it a ball or a strike? They're not going to give you four strikes and seven balls.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Their job is to call what's there based on what came before.
But we understand what's going on because they're blurring the lines here. Like, you've got another article on Catholic schools and same-sex marriages, an emerging legal clash. And it brought me back in the early 90s. I was teaching in a Catholic high school, and there was an individual there who, from all extensive purposes, lived in a same-sex relationship. But this was before the internet, Charlie, before social media, and never spoke of it. Like, it was never brought up. It was never talked about. The person never came to any events. He just privately lived his life that way. Now, I know some listeners are like, oh, man, they should have done something about it. But it was a time where
it was, you know, he kept his private life private. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense, Charlie.
And, yeah, I mean, a friend of mine wrote an article some years ago that I cite in class. A teacher, and I formerly taught Catholic high school too, a teacher or a professor's private life is private unless or until it becomes public.
Yeah. And these days it's really hard to keep things private in the sense that we are live our lives out in social media. So what is the situation? Particularly Indiana has had a couple cases in regards to people in same-sex couples or relationships that work at Catholic institutions, and the Catholic institutions have let them go.
Right. Well, a good, great question, and that's been an ongoing situation for a while. To back up just real briefly, all these cases, well, two of the three cases were directly decided on Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, one part of which is a so-called ministerial exception. It allows officials in faith-based institutions, whether Roman Catholic or some form of other form of Christian or Jewish or what have you, to decide who best qualifies in so-called ministerial positions. And being a teacher in any kind of faith-based school certainly helps to spread the faith, if you will, even if one is not teaching religion. You witness to the values throughout the day. And again, I taught Catholic high school for 8.5 years, and so I can attest to that, as I'm sure you guys have. And so the issue there was, in two of the cases, it was two different lawsuits by the same-sex couple, two women. It came out that they were married, and the schools refused to renew their contracts. And the Seventh Circuit ruled that that's okay under the ministerial exception. Beyond that, it's my understanding, I don't have data, I can't show you a study, but most Roman Catholic schools now give individuals copies of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, in which it's pretty clear that same-sex marriage is not accepted. So they can't say they didn't know. And a point that I raised in this most recent article is that on another ground, if you want to be purely legal, without even getting into the religious dimension of it, individuals signed contracts in which they acknowledged to abide by the teachings of the Roman Catholic Church and chose not to. And something that I think Todd had suggested with the situation where he had worked, we all do something that violates Roman Catholic Church teachings. Some of our actions are more private than others. But when it comes to light, we're accountable. And in these situations, the women knowingly were in violation of Catholic Church teaching, and the court ruled in their favor. Now, interestingly, there's another case coming out of South Carolina where a federal trial court ruled in favor of the teacher, and who was dismissed. He was a substitute, and he was dismissed from his position they chose not to reassign him to come to work, because he announced that he was entering a same-sex marriage, and in fact did. Mm-hmm. The trial court there rejected the ministerial exception. Hmm. Because the guy did not teach religion, and that school had a unique situation. They didn't even ask whether people were Roman Catholic when they hired them, and they don't even have data on who's Catholic and who's not Catholic in that school. But that said, some of the groups supporting the school are trying to tie in 303 Creative, the website designer, that this is expressive contact or expressive conduct, that you can't be made to associate with people who don't share your values.
Well,
and if religious freedom is going to mean anything, that seems to make sense to me. I respect whatever one's lifestyle is, who you choose to live with is entirely your business, and you're entitled to a life of happiness. But if you teach in a faith-based school, and these happen to be a Roman Catholic, then you kind of got to play by the rules.
And it seems to me, too, when you apply for a school and you sign that ethics policy, that you are agreeing to that. So you don't have to, at the onset, apply to teach at a Catholic school. But it's also not just Catholics. I saw a case this past week, Charlie, where a teacher who taught, like, in a Baptist school went to a drag show in Texas. And they ended up firing her because she put it on social media. And their point was, in their contract, that you can't post things on social media that are against our Baptist lifestyle policies.
Oh, exactly. And then I have a case book in school law for the courses I teach. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember the name of the case. I could send it to if you wanted. But a case from Louisiana about 10 years ago, a young woman literally signed her contract at lunch to teach in a Christian school. In it, it said, or included rather, language that she would not consume alcohol. She went right from signing her contract to a local restaurant where she downed a couple of cold ones. School officials found out that she was drinking alcohol, and they terminated her contract, and the court upheld it. They said, you signed a contract.
Yeah, I know.
I didn't think you were serious, Charlie. I didn't think you were serious.
One of the things I do for fun is I play ice hockey, and I played with a really wonderful guy who sadly passed away of a heart attack, but he taught at Cedarville University here in Ohio. And here's a guy who was in his 50s. They have language in their contract. They won't smoke or drink.
Uh-huh. See?
And they abide by it. I mean, if you sign the contract as an adult, it's an open-ended agreement. Uh-huh. It's not even getting into lifestyle choices so much as it is abiding by the terms of your contract. And one of my frustrations with all this is we keep hearing about respect, which we should, but respect is a two-way street.
Amen.
Yeah.
If you want me to respect your choices, then respect my values.
Exactly. Charlie Russo, thanks for joining us today on LA Catholic Morning. Always good to have you on.
Thanks, Charlie.
I'm happy to chat with you guys at any time. Thanks much, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
You too.
Thanks. Take care. Bye-bye now.
Check out his writings in CatholicWorldReport.com.
Man, glad somebody's keeping up with all the legal schmeagle.
I know. Peter Heather's joining the show next, The History of Formation of Christendom. It's a big mouthful, but we're going to cover the entirety of it in 15 minutes, Todd. So stay with us on L.A. Catholic
Morning.
Where the heart is, then my heart lives by the bay.